another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream.
Hi, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. One man's view of the changing world and the changing economic times. The things we can do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Folks, you got me on a Monday morning commute here. Beautiful out. It's in the 70s, low 70s. And I hate to say it, but I think that we're getting some vicarious calm before the storm for the folks in South Florida and eventually either South Texas or South Louisiana. Before I go into the different aspects of today's show, I really want to talk just briefly about Ike. One of the things that we can do, and I just, you know, wholeheartedly believe this, that actually matters, is you can think about people and send them prayers, send them positive thoughts, whatever your view of spirituality and prayer is, send that to people that are in other parts of the world that are going to go through some tough times, because it does matter. There's even been scientific studies on sick people that were prayed for versus sick people that weren't prayed for, and the sick people did better that were prayed for. So we know that we don't fully understand that, and we all have different religious beliefs and different spiritual beliefs. We all have different explanations for it, but what we do know is it does matter and it does work. So think about these people. Now, folks that are down in like Dade County, South Florida, the Keys, it looks like, don't make your decisions based on me. You're not going to get the eye of the hurricane. You're not going to get the eye wall and the worst part of Ike. You're going to get the side of it, and it hopefully won't be as bad as some of the prior hurricanes, something like Andrew. I don't think we're looking at that this time, even though I was really afraid something like that could happen with this storm. But you're going to get something. And if your local officials advise you to get out of there, I advise you to do it. My bigger concern now than South Florida is once the storm gets into the Gulf of Mexico, what I said last week is it was either going to be a Texas coastline or a Louisiana coastline that would probably bear the brunt of it. The storms just didn't seem to be turning up the Florida coast like they have in the past. And that when it got in the Gulf, it would strengthen. And that's exactly what the forecast is. And they're looking somewhere around the Port Arthur, Texas area for landfall to be made, which means the backside of the hurricane again will be, the outer bands will be hitting New Orleans. You guys in New Orleans may be told to get out of there. I heard people from New Orleans on the TV this week saying, we just got back and we ain't leaving again this year. All I can say to you, if you're told to get out and you choose to stay and you end up stranded, tough shit. I hate to put it that bluntly, but tough shit. If you stay when you're told to get out of that place. New Orleans is below sea level. Lake Pontchartrain and the ocean are at sea level. Okay, you're in a hole between two giant bodies of water and a major hurricane system is moving into the area. If you're asked to evacuate and you don't evacuate, I think we should spend all our resources helping the people in the areas that did what they were supposed to do, rebuild their cities, and you can find a rowboat or something. So, again, if you're told to get out from anywhere, it's probably a good idea to get out. It's inconvenient, but if you make the preparations that we talk about on the show, it can be more convenient than it is at other times. You should be prepared to leave, even if you live in a place like Dallas, where there's not as many threats as there are on the coast. We're prepared to leave if we have to. If you're not prepared to leave and you live on a coastline where hurricanes hit, then I'm telling you, you're just not taking life seriously. And I imagine nobody listening to this show is going to be one of those people that's going to stay there and say, I ain't leaving because I left already. Those people probably don't listen to this show. So I just figure that's some sentiments you guys have too, and maybe you feel a little bit better to hear me making that statement. Anyway, enough on Ike. Just know it's a very serious, very dangerous storm. And it is coming, and it's something to be taken seriously. And again, think about the people that are going to be affected by it, no matter where they are. And again, if you're told to get out, get out. All right, so what's today's show? Today's show is going to be my second edition of what I call Around the Net. This is where I go out to various websites and blogs and look for stories that other people that talk about survivalism and survivalist mentality and financial issues, green energy, anything like we discuss here are discussing, and comment on, you know, their stories, give them some publicity. I'm starting to build up a pretty big reader base, and some of these guys are bigger blogs, and some of them are really small, you know, one guy or two guys in Austin or something that just start started a blog on Blogger, and you know, maybe they only get a couple dozen visitors a day. And if it helps them, great. I mean, the more we can help other people get their message out and spread the word about what we're trying to do, the more lives we'll eventually save. Because some of these things are definitely more than just life impacting; they're life threatening. Hurricanes are one example, and more people every day are starting to pay attention to the types of things that we talk about here and are starting to take action. So the first story that I found was on the No Nanny State blog, and this story is actually everywhere. You've heard this by now, I'm sure. It's on CNN and Fox News and everything else, and it's the bailout, not really a bailout, the takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac by the federal government. All right, and basically what's happened is the federal government stepped in and just basically said, we're taking over operations. We're going to bail this thing out, and we're going to figure out how to handle it, but we're going to run it, we're going to control it. We now own, as a nation, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. That means that you and I now as a nation own Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And that basically means we now have the bank... The bank's bank, because Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, that's what they do, is they loan money to the other banks to make mortgages with, in complete control with the federal government. And on this blog, this post was by a guy that calls himself the Other Mike. So I guess there's two Mikes on that blog. And he starts out with a quote by Napoleon. And I can't give it to you exactly because I don't do this with a script at all, but as I remember it, it's when the government depends on the bankers for money, the government is no longer in control. Because when money is lent or given from one hand to another, the hand that is giving is higher than the hand that is receiving. And you really have to think about that. I mean, Napoleon was kind of a dictator and a, you know, emperor and a real warlord that was out trying to take over half the world for France. But that's really a pretty wise statement right there. That when the government is in you know, controlled by the banking system, the government's no longer in control. Well, that's what we have with the Federal Reserve. And that doesn't really tie into this story, but he had the quote, and I liked it, so I wanted to point it out. Let me give you the lowdown, though, of what the upshot of this thing is. We're saddled with the entire debt now of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. All their debt, all the holes, we have to fill them back in. Now remember, I've done a show on the national debt before. Our public national debt, which is a disaster, but just the public government debt, not the consumer debt, not foreign debt, just the normal on-the-books public debt from the United States government is currently $9 trillion we're in debt. Well, we've just increased that $9 trillion by either $1.25 to $1.5 trillion. That's how much money we just added to our debt now. $1.25 to $1.5 trillion. Just lumped on. In other words, our national debt, by making this move, just grew 10%. Think about that. Our national debt grew 10% in about 10 minutes. All right? And that's just the public debt, again. The public open books debt. If you don't understand what I'm saying when I say that, listen to my podcast on the national debt. I'll put a link to it from the show notes here so you can get a full understanding of where, you know, kind of all the buckets that what amounts to about $103 trillion, where that's allocated and how it adds up. But the upside of this thing is, again, we now owe another trillion-plus dollars. To put that number in perspective for you, because we've gotten, like, so sticker-shocked by the government and its debt and its spending that a lot of times when you hear a number like that, it just doesn't mean anything anymore. Our entire national budget per year is about $3 trillion. In other words, our government spends about $3 trillion a year, and we just increase what we have to spend by over a third of an annual national debt budget by taking on a company that is two companies that are completely bankrupt and are holding the mortgages to probably 60 to 70% of the homes, residential homes in America. I'm not sure about that figure. I'll check that as I post the show notes here, but I guarantee you it's a lot. If you went to your neighbors and asked two of them if they got an FHA or VA loan through Freddie or Fannie, odds are that one of the two would definitely tell you yes, and odds are that if you didn't, the other one probably did too. I would say it's at least two out of three, just from the people I've talked to, especially when you're talking about the typical consumer home. the typical family home that normal Americans, middle Americans can afford across the nation, not these million-dollar pieces of crap in California that you idiots out there are willing to pay $1 million for. I'm talking about standard three-bedroom, two-bath, $100,000 to $200,000 homes all over America. Those homes are, by and large, the working man's home, backed by Freddie and Fannie. And they're now completely defunct because so many people can no longer afford to pay their mortgage because even in that price bracket, people bought what they could not afford, what they should not have bought. If you ever want to get an education into the psychology of the buyer of homes and see people spend money they do not have, tune into HGTV and watch a show called House Hunters. Watch people come in and say, our budget is $195,000, and watch them buy a $245,000 house 15 minutes later. And you'll understand how we got in this mess. But one way or another, this is a big problem. It's a big deal. Now, what does it mean? Okay, short term, it's good. Short term, it's very good. You're going to see the market rally today like we haven't seen in a long time. Investors know now that we're not going to have that giant domino drop in the short term. That the government is going to bail it out for a while. Whatever it's got to do, and it's going to hold it past Election Day, you can bet that, because no one wants to lose their job, and that may be why the timing worked out the way that it did. It's almost something that if you don't want to let the crash happen, you had to do it now. I'm not going to beat the government up for this, for taking the action, because if they didn't take the action, you could have a global economic meltdown from this one event. The big thing we've been talking about, this could be it if they didn't step in and fix it. My question with the government is, how are they going to fix it? Now, this other Mike guy over at the No Nanny State blog, who again I'll link to from the show notes, says what he thinks they should do is break it up into a bunch of little, you know, mini Freddie Macs and mini Fannie Mae's, the way they kind of did with the Bell system with AT&T back in the day, and keep them broken up. And let them each be managed individually, and I think that's a good idea. And normally I would say that the government has no business breaking up any business. But the government built Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The government backed Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are fascist companies, in my opinion. If the government wants to take them back, fine, because the government created them. The government took a stake in making sure they were profitable and no responsibility for their loss. And now we're eating it because that formula doesn't work, because when you give people a blank checkbook, they tend to buy everything they want. That's what happened with Freddie and Fannie. They threw money at people they should have never given money to because they had the blank check from the federal government to do it with. So in this case, it's not like the government grabbing, you know, some independent company that formed all by itself and grew all by itself and breaking them up. This is more of government breaking its own bureaucracy up. The big thing when you talk about mortgages, and these guys are also heavily involved, people don't realize it's the student loan business and a lot of other places where credit's extended. When you consolidate that to one giant company, then the risk is all in one place. If these little companies had been little regional companies, you know, let's say that these two behemoths were 8 to 10 little companies each, so we're talking about 16 individual lending institutions. If one of them got into trouble, number one, it would be easier to spot. Number two, it would be easier to correct. And number three, it wouldn't necessarily affect the other 15. So that's why I think that's a good plan. Overall, the best plan would be to divest these things, sell them off to investors, and get the government's hand out of them altogether. Yeah, break them up, but sell them off to complete private control and get out of that business. Because, again, when we look at what the government's doing, does the Constitution say it? Does the Constitution say that every American should be set up in a system where they can buy a house? No. It doesn't say that. Does it say the government should be backing lending institutions? No, it doesn't say that. Does it say the government should be guaranteeing loans of private citizens? No, it doesn't say that. All right? That means we should do it. It's that simple. So I want to break off that one now so I have time to get the rest of these in. But look, folks, if you need anything to tell you that it really is as bad as we think it is, you see those two behemoths now got to the point where even, you know, think about what happened a few months ago. The Fed said, we're not going to let this happen. They pumped a ton of money in. They basically said, tell us how much money you need and we'll print it. And even that didn't solve the problem. And it's a lot with the accounting processes, and the problem's bigger than we realize. And now that the government's taken over, we're going to find out how big the problem is. Now, what that's going to do is it's going to expose problems in other banks. And those major bank failures that we've been talking about, they're going to come. I think that the powers that be will do all they can to push that till after the election. It's bad for both parties if that happens. Incumbents on both sides can lose their jobs over this because people will really want change then. so they need some time. So I think they're starving this thing off the best they can with moves, and this was one of them. But again, it's just another reason to be prepared, have cash reserves, don't stay highly leveraged in the stocks. Okay, the next blog that I wanted to feature is a blog called The Total Survivalist Libertarian Rant Fest. And that's a mouthful. Don't worry. Again, if you go by the survivalpodcast.com, the link to that blog and this story will be on the show notes. And you can go by and read this guy's article. It's a pretty short article. And all he's really talking about is he had bought some silver coins on eBay to put away and have some silver coin for barter or just have some real money or just have an investment. And apparently a few of his items from his initial order didn't show up at first, and then they showed up, and now he can give the guys positive feedback. And he said he learned a lot about buying silver on eBay. Learned a lot about buying silver by buying silver on eBay, okay? So, anyway, I think it was just a cool little story, and I think it's a great little blog, and I wanted to feature it. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about silver and just the value that it represents. What most people don't realize about silver is there is a shortage of silver in the world. Because unlike gold, which is limited to how much industrial use it gets, purely because of how expensive it is, silver goes into a lot of industrial things. There's a huge demand for silver outside of jewelry and investor bullion, just to do things like certain electrical circuits have to be silver. Film, you know, we've kind of forgotten about film because we're in a digital age, but there's still a lot of film work that's done. Silver's used in that. Silver is actually harder to mine than gold in many instances. Silver veins tend to be something that will get a few inches thick and then go down to paper thin and come back out. It's pretty tough stuff to mine. It's usually closer to the surface than true veins of gold, which is why it seems to be more common. Honestly, there's not a hell of a lot more silver in circulation than there is gold in circulation, and silver's not that less rare than gold. The biggest difference between the two metals is that one is valued more because it's perceived to be valued more. Gold has a greater status symbol with jewelry, and going back to the ancient kings, it always has. It looks better, right? But silver's some pretty rare stuff. And I've told this before, but I want to say this again now to drive this home. 1935, if you had a silver quarter, which was a 1935 quarter, you know, something you would get as a paycheck, you know, go do some work, I give you some money, one of them is a silver quarter, and you tooled your little car, your little Ford car down to the, you know, local gas station and handed the man a quarter, he would put about a gallon of gasoline in your car. It's about what it bought in 1935. If you take that same 1935 quarter to a coin shop today, on the silver price, you'll get about $3 to $4 somewhere in that range for that quarter. It's a quarter ounce of silver. Silver's trading right now around $16 or something, maybe $18. All right, I don't know what the spot price is today, but it's been in that range, okay? So a quarter ounce of silver is going to be right in that range. What does that mean? That means that same quarter that bought you a gallon of gas in 1935 buys you a gallon of gas today. I don't think you could fill up a 16-ounce soda bottle with a standard-issue quarter today. So that just tells you that silver holds its value. And one thing we need to understand is if we do have a big economic meltdown, what's going to happen is the dollar's value will crash. As the dollar goes down, we saw this with gold. Gold made a huge surge for the early part of the year, and it's come back down some into this like $800 range. A big part of that surge, and what people don't realize, $800 is really high for gold. It's still way up there. It didn't drop. People are like, oh, the gold bull market's over. I don't believe that at all. I think gold's still a solid investment, too. But what happened is the dollar started to strengthen some, right? Because we just couldn't let it get too weak. So we started to bring it back. The powers that be at the Fed started to strengthen the dollar a bit. A lot of the erosion in that price is simply the dollar strengthening. What that teaches us is if the dollar weakens, then silver price goes up, gold price goes up. In other words, if I hold all my money in pounds, you know, sterling, British pounds, or euros, or what have you, and I own gold, and your dollar weakens, I'm not going to take my currency down to match so that I can exchange gold with you. On the world market, gold's going to retain its value. So if any individual currency weakens, it takes more of that currency to buy the gold. Same thing with silver. So as you're planning like your different way to allocate your assets, I think it's a great idea to have some money in silver. I think silver is a lot more affordable than gold, and it's a lot easier to break up into small pieces than gold that have lesser value. So if you ever do need to use it for barter or exchange, it's easier to do. So I think silver is a great idea. I think this is a great little post. And I really never thought about buying silver coins on eBay, but it's something I'm going to look into. Generally speaking, your best deals will be found if you can find some local coin shops and go by and tell them, hey, look, you know, I'm looking to get the best price I can on a few coins at a time. I'll take junk silver. I just want the intrinsic value of the coins. I'm not looking for numismatics. What do you got that you're willing to part with cheaply? Usually they'll make you some deals, sometimes under spot price, because these guys sit on such large inventories. Okay, that a lot of times they'd rather have some normal cash money, and they'll dump some of this stuff for, you know, obviously more than face value, but maybe even a little bit under the spot price for some of the rougher coins. But check out eBay, and I'm going to do the same, and if you find any good deals, you know, let me know. And I'll take a look at them and tell you what my thought of some of these deals are. Going on, I want to go to the next blog. It's called Codename Insight. And the guy that posts there uses that handle, Codename Insight, as well. So this is on Codename Insight by Codename Insight. And it's basically saying that the thing that bugs him the most in the survivalist community are the people that I guess I call the Tinfoil Hat Brigade, even though he's not using that. He says, basically, spare me the gung-ho survivalists that have gone off the deep end. And I could not agree more with that statement. And he goes a little further than I ever had on this subject by breaking down these, what he calls wackos, into two categories of wackos. Wacko number one, I can sum up what he was saying basically by saying that these are the people that are like, I'm so great, everybody love me. These are the people that go on and on. They've got 20 years of food. They did everything right, and you did everything wrong. And, you know, they have everything that they need, and they're so smart. And a lot of times they exaggerate, and a lot of times they're flat out liars. And I'll get into that in a second, because he had more to say about that, specifically lying about service and positions held in the past, etc. Before I do that, though, whack out number two. These are the guys, and to me there's a lot of crossover between these two groups, so I do get what he's saying on breaking them apart, who are ready to take on the government and the New World Order with guns. All right, these are the guys that they've got their AR-15 main battle rifle. They're ready to go out there and fight the battle. They're stockpiling explosives. They're the kind of people that make the government take a strong and unkind look at all of us. All right, they attract attention that we don't need and we don't want, and they're not very realistic because, again, I don't care how much guns and ammunition you have stockpiled. If you're holed up in a place and we ever get to a kind of place where you're actually perceived as a threat by the government, they'll drop one shell on you and you're done. They'll level your house. They'll put a JDAM through your roof if you want to take it that far. And that's part of what he's saying is that these people that are out there looking to fight, right, and they want to hose everybody down with automatic weapons fire and they're super militant and all this stuff, that's the most likely way to get yourself killed in a bad situation. And if you get yourself killed, that kind of precludes surviving. In other words, if you die, you can't survive. And since the survivalist's main goal is actually to survive, hence the name survivalist. Hold on, folks. All right, pause there. I mean, you know I got road noise around me, but I had sirens, and there's a major wreck up here, I guess. So I'm moving kind of slow in the car, which is good because I can actually look at my notes a little bit better safely. But anyway, if you're taking that approach of I'm going to survive by, you know, being ready to shoot everybody and that gets you killed, then you're not really a survivalist. I thought it was pretty insightful. And it's what I'm saying a lot of times when I talk about tinfoil hat-wearing freaks. These are the people that I'm talking about. But he goes on to talk about liars, right? And he says a lot of these liars say things like they were a soldier or a war hero, a cop or a firefighter, etc. He tells a story. And I can relate to this story because I've done similar things to people in the past. He said he was at some kind of a group or party. I don't remember what it was. But there was a guy that was going on and on about Vietnam. You know, not Vietnam, Vietnam, Nam. When we were in Nam this and we were in Nam that. And he was throwing around so many insider terms, the guy sounded very convincing, and he sounded very full of himself. But the guy was looking at him going, you look kind of young. So he just says to the guy, well, how old are you? And the guy or says, what year were you born? Said, how old are you? That's what he said. So the guy says, well, whatever age he was. And I don't know because he doesn't disclose that or what year this actually occurred. But the guy says, oh, okay. And then, you know, he said he's not really the greatest math guy in the world. So it took him a little bit of time to figure this out. But a few moments later, he comes back to the guy. He says, you know, if you were born in whatever year it was, then you would have been 12 years old during the fall of Saigon, which is when we left Vietnam. So, you know, and kind of left it at that. And then the room fell silent, and everybody looked at the guy. And he said, you know, maybe I need a little bit better coaching with how to be politically correct or handle diplomacy in a situation like that. I mean, personally, I think that when somebody is dishonoring people that have served, and I don't care if it's a soldier or in a war or as a firefighter, and they're dishonoring them by claiming the things that others have done and bled for and suffered for, and even simply just put effort into that they did and they should be exposed. And the odds are, this guy not only wasn't in Nam, he probably wasn't even in the Army. Hell, this guy probably wasn't even a freaking Cub Scout, all right? So, you know, kudos to this guy, whoever the guy here is his real name that actually made this exposure. Good for him. He calls himself he calls himself Codename Insight. So, yeah, kudos to this guy for doing that. And if you get a chance again, buddy, if you ever hear my podcast, do it again. I mean, let people know that these guys are full of crap. The other thing he talks about is that, you know, true survivalists, and I love this, true survivalists do things like set up college funds for their kids. Right? Figure out how they can help other people. They save money. You know, they run their household well. They teach their kids to be upstanding citizens. That's what being a survivalist is really all about. So, hey, the guy, whoever you are that calls yourself Codename Insight, good for you, man. Dead on, spot on. And give this guy's blog a read, because I think he's got a lot of wisdom there by bringing that to our attention. Then the next thing that I wanted to briefly mention, and I'm going to be brief on this one because I don't have the full story yet, but this actually came from Newsmax.com, which isn't really an individual blog, I don't think anyway. I think it's more of a true news source. But I just picked this up this morning. Venezuela is going to be hosting the Russians for naval exercises in the Caribbean. And basically, four Russian ships are going to be, pulling into Venezuelan waters and doing some collaboration with them. They're going to be doing this on November 10th through 14th, which is going to come right after Election Day. So that's interesting timing to that. But my point here is, again, we've got a lot of military tension right now. And Hugo Chavez down there in Venezuela is doing a lot of saber rattling and talking a big game. And I think he's doing this just to tell the U.S. government, hey, you know what? The Russians have my back. Now, if I were Mr. Chavez, I'd get that in writing. I wouldn't necessarily trust the Russians really have his back. They've got a lot of their own problems and their own issues. But with the stuff that's going on in Georgia right now and the tension between the U.S. and Russia, I would ask our public officials to take a back step here and look at what's going on and decide how much saber-rattling we really want to do. I'm all for fighting for independence and liberty. I'm all for if I have to defend my nation, laying down my life. I don't want a war with Russia. And I don't think Russia has any intention whatsoever to invade the United States or any of our territories. I don't think they do at all. I don't think they have the stomach for it. I don't think they want it. And I don't think that they need to. And I don't think it's a good idea for them, and I don't think they want a nuclear war any more than we do. And if those two powers get into it, that's a real probability. But if we're stupid, we can escalate things. And we can harm ourselves either with an eventual military exchange, which, again, we don't want. It would probably be a military exchange through surrogates. If you look at Korea, Korea was really a military exchange between China and the U.S. through the surrogate of North and South Korea that suffered greatly for our ignorance. And that's too bad, but that's, you know, most likely. And if it's a direct exchange, it could be really bad. So it's just one more thing to keep an eye on. And, it tells us we could be going back into a Cold War mentality again, which really is not the place for the global marketplace at this time. What we need is independent sovereign nations and independent sovereign states doing their own thing, being left alone by others. Liberty to return to at least our country, if not the world. It doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. And this thing with the Russians is something really to keep an eye on. So the next little story I want to go over is from the Stealth Survival blog by a guy that calls himself Riverwalker. And I really like this guy. I've read his blog quite a bit, and I've read some of his posts on some various forums. He's a real good guy. And he's also pretty insightful. And what he's really talking here is about just basic being prepared. In case you have to evacuate from the weather or, you know, really anything. And what his real big point is that most people think that during an evacuation, if they ever have to leave, they'll just, you know, pick up whatever they need on the way. Well, folks, Ike's not to Florida yet, and on Saturday it wasn't even close yet, but it was pretty obvious that the people in the Keys in South Florida maybe needed to get the heck out of Dodge. Well, they had news guys there, you know, on site like they always do, because apparently news guys are immune to, you know, hurricanes and lightning and wind and drowning. So they can go to places like this and stand there while the hurricane hits while they tell us to leave. Anyway, I digress. What I noticed was how many places they were showing signs on the gas stations that said no gas. Right? So this is only the beginning of an evacuation. You put a, this is what people don't understand. Our entire supply chain is ran at a level for maximum consumption and minimal inventory overlay. In other words, stores do not want, gas stations do not want, nobody wants inventory to sit any longer than it has to. They want, the perfect way to run a gas station would be, that you can't do this, you have to have some reserves to run a gas station, but perfection would be, as the final drop is going into the last customer's car, the new fuel truck is pumping it in. Okay? That would be perfection. And in all areas of stores and merchants, that's what people strive for, as close to that as they can. The second the last loaf of Wonder Bread is leaving the shelf, the Wonder Bread guy is putting a new loaf of Wonder Bread on. That'll never get that perfect, but if you understand that's what the goal is, to have this very small pocket of reserve, as soon as you put an uptick on demand, all right, capacity no longer works, and you run out and you have shortages. And that's reality. So, I mean, you know, kind of expanding on his thoughts about this, his big point was having cash. That most people won't have cash. So they think they're going to use their credit cards. Well, the power's out, you can't use it, right? You can't get to the bank because you have to leave. Some of the banks may be shut down. There's all different reasons to have cash, and you always said to have cash. My thoughts are, you know, expanding on that, these are the things that everybody should have. You should have a good 72-hour kit. And I've done a podcast on that before. I'll probably do another one because I've come up with some new ideas about that. In fact, I'm thinking about putting together a 72-hour kit contest. I'll give you details at a show later this week, but I think that would be kind of cool. And I'm going to see if I can get some sponsors to put up some pretty cool gear to the winner of this contest. Don't get too much into that yet. But anyway, just know that's coming. Be listening for it either tomorrow or the next day. The next thing is have gas. If you live in a place that's hurricane-prone or disaster-prone, it's probably good for everybody, but definitely people that live in places like South Florida, the Keys, New Orleans, South Alabama, South Texas, down there by Port Arthur, all these places that routinely get hit by hurricanes. It's probably a good idea for you guys to, you know, maybe if you have a pickup truck, get yourself 2 5-gallon gas cans and keep those full. And whenever you fill your truck, you know, dump those 10 gallons in and then fill the truck and add the 10. The first time you put those 10 gallons in, you're going to pay for them. But after that, the price of gas every week is going to be the same. You're just creating some reserve for yourself. You can do the same thing with a car. You can do it no matter what you're driving to have some. And I've talked about this before, but I think it makes enough sense to have enough reserve gas to go at least 200 miles. So it's not really how many gallons. It's how, what is your range? 200 miles for me in my Jetta, for instance, is, what, geez, that's about 5 gallons. I can go 200 miles. For a truck, it's about 10 gallons. You know, for most trucks, you get about 20 miles a gallon. If your truck gets 10 miles a gallon, well, 200 miles is 20 gallons. So if you can get 200 miles, generally 95% of all disasters, you're going to be able to get out of where you're at and somewhere, you know, approaching normal. Now, if there's a major national disaster or global disaster that's just, you know, shuts things down everywhere, hopefully you'll have enough fuel to get wherever your bug out location is, or what have you. But in most situations, when we're being reasonable, when we're not being gung-ho and a tinfoil hat brigade guy, we'll understand that that'll get us out of there. Obviously, the cash that River Walker mentions is important. Have maps. And the biggest thing, folks, is know where the hell you're going to go. I think the most problem with most evacuees is they have no idea where they're going. They just kind of start going, if they're in the south and the hurricane's coming from below them, they start going north. right? Have multiple routes planned to get the hell out of Dodge, and, you know, get a jump on it. Go early. If nothing happens, it's going to be easy to come back. Getting out at the last minute is going to be very, very difficult, so knowing where you'll go. So that wraps up pretty much everything. There's one story I wanted to shove in here at the end, though. I saw this just before I walked out the door on Newsmax again. And that is that a judge has okayed the bankruptcy filing of the city of Vallejo, California. So basically, the city of Vallejo is bankrupt. And the Firefighters and Police Officers Union tried to sue to stop the bankruptcy claim because obviously they're going to, you know, lay people off and cut pensions and do other things. They're going to say, we're out of money. Well, the court said, no, the city can declare bankruptcy. Now, I want to talk to you, if you're a union guy, here about reality for a second. See, the Police Officers Union, the Fire Department Union and all, they were trying to prevent this, all right? But the problem with preventing it is the money's not there. They can't just crap money. That's why the judge okayed this, because he said, you know what, they are bankrupt. The legal requirements to declare bankruptcy is to be out of money. And a lot of you guys that are depending on big retirements and big pension programs from some of these major corporations still have them, or even if they're gone now that they did exist, and you're one of the guys that, you know, has it coming in from them, especially automakers and airlines, you know, don't think that they can't do the same thing eventually, because when the money runs out, the money runs out. When there's no water going in the hose, you can have a court order that requires water to come out the other end. It's not going to happen. That's what's happened here with the city of Vallejo. So I told you before that we've had, you know, budget cuts in Dallas, shortfalls in Dallas, shortfalls in Fort Worth, and times are pretty good here in this area. And with that said, they've had to lay people off, they've had to do things. Now here we have a city government actually declaring bankruptcy. That's just one more wake-up call for you folks. To me, this is the writing on the wall. Be prepared. Step up your preparations. All of these things that we've talked about today, all of these things we talked about on the show, be prepared to, you know, make it for a while without support. Be prepared to defend what you have. Be prepared to not lose all your money by having everything vested in stock funds for the long haul, because you may need some money short term. Have some gold or silver. Have food reserves. You know, these are just basic things that you don't have to be a gung-ho freak survivalist to do. And here's what I want to close on today. The gung-ho stuff. The tinfoil hat brigade. You might wonder why I'm so tough on those guys. All right? And even though I'm tough on them, I'm saying, you're welcome here, because sometimes those guys actually think of some pretty cool stuff, and they come up with some good ideas. My big problem with them is I think they do a lot more harm than good. Because I think Joe Average, that's out there, that's starting to look at all this stuff going, oh man, this doesn't look right. And occasionally they get a normal guy on the news with some basic advice that says, hey man, you might want to back off on these stocks in your 401k. You might want to have some cash in the house. Maybe he turns Glenn Beck on, and here's Glenn Beck, so, you know, have some food. You know, and he starts to think, reads the Wall Street Journal thing, all these little things that are starting to leak out of the mainstream press. Then he goes and starts looking at the survivalist community, and the first people you usually find are these freaking freaks, right? And you got this guy, I'm a former Green Beret, probably wasn't even a freaking Cub Scout, won the Medal of Honor in Vietnam, and I'm ready to go, and I've got 47 cases of MREs, and I've got my bug out location, I've got bunkers, I've got a camp, and the guy goes, I don't want that. I don't want to be that. So maybe he takes a step of, you know, buying a couple boxes of pasta and a few cases of water, and he thinks he's done something, but it's really only as far as he's willing to go. And he stops the education process. And he doesn't become a member of our community because he thinks that's our community. So that's why I have a big problem with those folks. My other problem with them is, folks, you know, they just, the lying thing. The claiming you were a war hero. The claiming you won a medal you didn't win. It's disgraceful. And it just should not be done. And it's spitting in the face of the people that did it. And if you're a vet, if you're a war veteran, I have a cause for you to follow. This is what I want you to do. I want you to just mentally prepare in your head for the next time you run across one of these people, which you will sooner or later, to have some questions that anybody that was really a vet would know the answer to. And this guy could claim to be special ops, and I can't tell you, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you might ask him something like, well, who was the Secretary of Defense while you were in the military? You know, most people should remember that. Or you know, there's a lot of things you could ask. You know, I was airborne. So when people start telling me about, you know, being Green Beret, well, I know all the Green Berets are airborne qualified. So there's some real basic stuff that any Green Beret would know about the airborne corps, and I'm not going to give that away because I don't want to, you know, seed the lies for these people. But I'll ask things, you know, about, you know, preparing gear or, you know, hey, do you remember when? And I don't do it like I'm being accusational. I do it like I'm just like, hey, man, do you remember this? You know, I see how they answered. If they answered they're full of crap, I call them on it. And I'll tell them, hey, man, you weren't Green Beret because you weren't even in the Army Airborne. See, you don't know something that you should know. And the type of training you get there is drilled into your mind. People tell me they were in the Army. First thing I say is, hey, man, you remember your first general order? And if they don't pop out with, I will guard everything within the limits of my post and quit my post only when properly relieved, I know they're full of crap because I learned that in 1990. All right? But I sure as hell will never forget it. I'll probably be an old senile man. I won't forget that. So that's just kind of my final thoughts on this. You know, have a tremendous amount of respect for firemen, for policemen, for soldiers, for Marines, for airmen, for sailors, because these guys put their lives on the line, and they do it every day. People even think about, like, local cops in a small town, and they think, well, they're not really putting their life on the line. Trust me, buddy, they're putting their life on the line. Making a simple traffic stop. All right, you're putting your life on the line, and some idiot will come and run you over while you're trying to do your job. Even if it's not writing tickets, let's say it's rendering because people get, you know, tickets, and they weren't writing tickets. Fine, not right. Guys broke down on the side of the road. Cop stops to help them. For some reason, people seem to hit cop cars with lights on. It's almost like they'd be better off not turning their lights on. It's like a moth in a flame. These guys work hard. And these soldiers that are overseas, if you don't agree with the war, I don't care. But I have some real problems with the Iraq war, the way it's being handled right now. I have some major problems with both political parties' views of what we should be doing militarily. But you know what? That's my brother soldier out there. And if they're a Marine or an airman, you know, hey, man, they're a brother too. They're a brother in combat arms. And I have a lot of respect for those guys. And what people don't realize is when you're in combat, it's not about this big overview. It's not all this patriotism that gets lumped up with it. You're really out there, and what you're on the line for is the guy next to you and the guy on the other side of you. It's taking care of each other. And by taking care of each other, you get the mission accomplished. You take care of everybody else. So kind of remember that and be thinking about those guys. We're going to come up into the holiday season. I'll say more on it. But make sure not only are you sending your thoughts and prayers to those folks you're going to be dealing with, like, think about our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines overseas, because those guys deserve it too. And please tune in tomorrow for another edition of the Survival Podcast. And we'll keep trying to fulfill our mission. And again, remember what that is. Helping you figure out how to live a better life if times get tough. Or even if they don't.
You can scream. And you can holler. It really doesn't matter. Because it all gets spent.